to, because one of the experts on that, topic is sitting opposite me. So,
There's two reasons for morningness and eveningness, and it really does exist. One is genetics. There's a genetic predisposition to be a morning person or an evening person, but also development. From about the age of 10, there's a tendency to get up later and later and later. Boys get later and later and later, and peak at around about 21 and a half. Women peak at around about 19, and then we start to get earlier and earlier and earlier. And by the time we're 55, 60, we're getting up and going to bed at about the age of when we were 10. So there's probably a major hormonal influence, influencing sleep timing. But on average, there's about a 2-hour difference in somebody in their late teens. They want to go to bed 2 hours later than somebody in their late 50s, early 60s.
But that's tied to the stimulus is light, presumably.
Light will lock on this internal clock to the external world. And certainly if you get morning light, then it can advance the clock and make you get up a bit earlier.
Yeah, I went to a wedding once right up in northern Sweden around this time of year, and everyone was there for about 4 or 5 days, and everybody went completely nuts because it never got dark, and people were eating their dinner at midnight. No one had any idea what time to have meals. I mean, it was really odd, because I thought, well, we're all grown-ups. We all roughly know. We can all read our watches. We'll just do it when the watch says it, not when the sun or the moon says it. But everyone, even me, we all just went completely berserk.
Yeah. I mean, in shift work, for example, you know, 20 years on the night shift, you do not adapt to the demands of working at night because the body clock is locked onto the light dark cycle. And so, you know, on the journey home, you're exposed to light, and that provides the key. Now, if you take night shift workers, you hide them from natural light during the day and increase the amount of light in the workplace, they will shift, just like you can get over jet lag. But that's, of course, not practical.
What reason? Sorry.
I was going to say, in terms of being an owl and a lark, so owls obviously go to bed late and wake up late, and larks the opposite, there's some psychological work suggesting that is linked to personality traits. Yeah. And so owls tend to be a little bit more intelligent. I'm an owl. Tend to be a little bit more intelligent, certainly more creative, more gullible about personality traits which are positive towards themselves, and also more likely to be psychopaths. So it's an interesting odds to be put into the mix there.
Katie, I was thinking, talking about that kind of morning-evening thing, and whether it's genetic or not, I never, even though I get up at 7.30 every morning, I'd go to bed very, very late, and I think, I must go to bed earlier, and then it just gets... And I presume that was merely due to the inevitability of death and the finite nature of existence.
Yeah.
What do you think, as a religious scholar?
Ah, good. Yes, as your resident theologian. It's just, fear of judgment, Robin, is what's keeping you up at night.
What kind of personality?
Worries do keep us up at night, don't they? And they are that sort of sense of obsessive anxiety at night. Why does that, the thing that I don't understand is, why is it that you can be exhausted all day, but as soon as you lie down to go to sleep at night, everything that's been worrying you all day suddenly comes into your mind and you're unable to sleep for another 4 hours? It just seems, that seems evolutionarily ridiculous.
Have you ever been an insomniac?
Myself?
Yeah.
Only when I was a teenager. I'm not as an adult. I'm all right. I'm quite all right as an adult. I'm sort of like a toddler again. I don't quite know why. I think I'm just in deep denial. Like, I just refuse to address any of the horrific problems that I am encountering in day-to-day life. So I'll just go to sleep and hope they're not there when I wake up.
Maybe, Richard, I mean, maybe do you have an answer for that? I mean, why is it that you get this? Because everybody probably has this from time to time, where you're absolutely, totally tired, and you cannot go to sleep.
Well, we all have worries and concerns, and during the day we're pretty good at pushing those outside of our kind of conscious awareness. And also there's other stuff going on, so we're distracted. You lay down in a dark room and you're physically tired and you haven't got those distractions and you haven't got maybe the mental energy, as it were, to sort of push them away, and they start to come and then feed on themselves. Now you start not to sleep, so you get even more anxious, and so the whole thing feeds on itself. So it is an issue, and there are things that, I mean, if you, for example, deal with those anxieties in all sorts of ways, you actually sleep better. Well, there's a very strong relationship between being a very anxious person, having worries and concerns, and the quality of your sleep.
Katie, you were, you've recently become a parent, not that long ago. I hadn't talked about that. Just that bit where you have disrupted sleep, that moment where you think that you'll never eat any hot food again.
Yeah.
The warmest thing you'll eat will have fallen out of your baby's mouth.
And fallen out of my own breath.
But how do you, I don't know if you experienced disrupted sleep or not, I wondered whether you felt that had affected you, how that affected your mental state.
Oh, yeah, no. At one point, I was just crawling around the house crying because I needed to have some sleep. But I go crazy when I don't have enough sleep. Definitely, it has a huge impact on just the impact of two or three nights of very badly disrupted sleep in a row can have a massive impact on my general outlook, my positivity, optimism. Everything's a catastrophe. I can't cope with anything. Everything makes me sit down and have a cry on the kitchen floor. And yeah, obviously, I mean, we'll all have experienced it in terms of being a new parent, is especially if you are breastfeeding or so on, you know, you're literally trying to sleep every hour, every 2 hours. And I always believed in the impact of a lack of sleep. But when I was young, I survived on very little sleep and I didn't really need it. But now I need a lot. And I just noticed that I would be deranged within a week if I didn't have sort of better.
Do we know, Richard, what enough sleep is?
It really varies. So, you know, there's a sort of normal distribution. Some people are naturally short sleepers. You had Margaret Thatcher, who could sleep on, survive allegedly on 4 hours sleep.
And stay entirely sane.
Yeah, yes, that's going to say.
Balance.
Yes, she's a great advert for short sleep.
I've never understood why people hold her up as the model for lack of sleep.
Absolutely.
It's just absolutely baffling. Mussolini could get through on 3 hours sleep a night. No, he couldn't.
So you have naturally short sleepers, you have naturally long sleepers. In general, sort of 8 hours is seen as the sort of adult marker in terms of where that normal distribution lies.
And does it matter where you have it? As Katie said, that you could get 2 hours, 2 hours, 2 hours, 2 hours. Does it have to be continuous to be...
It's better if it is. So it's not the sort of thing where you go, I'll get 4 hours at night and then I'll sleep 4 hours during the afternoon. That 4 hour sleep in the afternoon, first of all, it will disrupt the evening sleep, and second, it won't be such good quality as the night's sleep. So you're much better off trying to get it pretty much in one single block, except for that 20-minute period when the circadian rhythm naturally drops in the early afternoon, when you really should be taking a nap, if that's what your body is telling you to do.
Mm. Ooh, I might disagree slightly on that one. You have to be slightly careful with napping, because a nap in the middle of the afternoon, particularly for most of us, is maybe not such a good thing. What it represents is that the sleep pressure has built up faster than the clock can sort of counteract that, and so you have that mid-afternoon dip. Now, a 20-minute nap can be sort of okay. It makes the second half of the day sort of a little bit easier. Anything more than that, and you go to deeper sleep, and then recovery from that is completely counterproductive. The big problem about napping is that it pushes back the sleep pressure, delays sleep onset at night. So you go to bed later, the alarm clock drives you out of bed at the same time, so you've had shortened sleep, you wake with less efficient sleep, and therefore you're more likely to need a nap the next day. So it's best avoided unless you really need it.
And this is a proper Radio 4 feud, isn't it? These people on there, they really did not agree on the benefit of napping. I think you should nap. No napping before 4.
No
one agreed on the napping by the end of it.
I think we did agree. I think the key is nap. It's a 15-20 minute nap. What you should not be doing is sleeping for an hour in the middle of the day. That's bad news. So I think we did agree. I think
you then argue for the long nap? Because we, at the moment, we haven't got enough antagonism for this to
I really
want this to be pick of the week.
I'm a huge advocate of the long nap. Getting up and going back to bed an hour later, I like, and then sleeping until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I don't think we've even started to cover drinking at lunchtime. Which I think is a really key thing that we're all missing now.
But is the idea that 20 minutes might be okay, because, but if you go into deep sleep, it's worse. So when you wake up from the different phases of sleep, does that have a very large effect on how long it takes you to recover, how your body clock may recover to that? Is it if you're woken up by your alarm, so you're dreaming, or you're in deep sleep, or
that's the interesting point. If you're woken up by your alarm, your body is telling you you need to sleep, and some outside force is telling you to wake up. So actually, really, you shouldn't be woken up by your alarm. You should be waking up normally, because your body's saying, actually, you've had enough sleep now, and now it's time to wake up. So if you are relying on your alarm, that's not good news. The other problem, as you say, with alarms is that, you know, if it wakes you up out of dream state, for example, you're very close to waking state. It's not going to make you feel too upset, and you're going to remember that you dream and so on. Even light sleep is like waking up from a nap. Deep sleep, you're not going to feel great. And so the sleep cycle really does impact on the sort of waking time, because even the quality of the last dream you have before you wake up, if it's a very positive dream and you remember it, you get out of bed in a good mood. If it's not so good, you get out of bed in a bad mood. So sleep is not separate to the daytime. The two are intertwined. And what's happened in the last sort of 20, 30 years is we've been pushing the night into a smaller and smaller segment of time, and we've been valuing the daytime. And I think we really do need to celebrate the night and go, hold on a second, there's a reason why almost every animal sleeps. It really matters to us.
No, I was just wondering whether, broadly speaking, in an ideal world without work and alarm clocks and things like that, should we be trying to force a schedule on our sleep patterns, or really should we just sleep whenever the mood takes us?
Going back to Richard's point, I think in how much sleep do we need? And I think we have to be really sensitive to our own individual demands. So if you need an alarm clock to get you out of bed in the morning, you're not getting enough sleep. If you sustain the waking day with lots of caffeinated drinks and nicotine and cigarettes and things, then, you know, chances are you're not getting enough sleep at night. And then what those stimulants will do, particularly caffeine, which can have a half-life of, you know, 5-9 hours, is that you then need to sort of reverse that at night. And so then there's the tendency to take alcohol and sleeping tablets. And they are sedatives. They're not biological mimics of sleep. And so they will actually interfere with some of the important things going on in the brain whilst we sleep.
So should you force yourself to go to bed earlier?
No, you shouldn't force yourself. You should just try and have a wind in thinking, right, I need, let's say, 8 hours. So at least half an hour, maybe even 60 minutes before you want to go to bed, your desired bedtime, you're winding down, you're minimizing light exposure, you're doing the sorts of things that relax you, you're turning off the telly, you're turning off the email, all those sorts
of
things.
Should you have really furious rows with strangers on Twitter?
That's bad. Yeah, never do those emails late at night. Okay. Yeah.
But I think I saw it some way you'd said that also one of the things that we all do that is counterproductive is then walk into a very bright bathroom. Yeah, to clean our teeth.
Absolutely. The last thing we do, you know, we stand in the most brightly lit room in the house looking into an illuminated mirror. And of course, light, in addition to locking the body clock onto the external world, has an acute effect on alertness. Bright light makes us more alert. And so what that increase in alertness will do is delay sleep onset, delay sleep. So it's good to minimize.
To clean your teeth in the dark.
Well, I had this fantasy that somebody should devise a sort of a bathroom mirror with sort of low red enriched light at night, and then in the morning bright blue enriched light. So you get your photon shower to set the clock in the morning.
I think you have just invented it. Well, why don't you make it and make a lot of money?
Well, yeah.
There you are. What are you doing here? Go.
Don't cut that out of the edit. It's not copyrighted. No one say anything.
I like the fact you're making people believe you clean your own teeth. they get sent into the BBC teeth cleaner, don't they? You've written a book also about insomnia as well and trouble with sleep. Just before we move on, that's one thing I wanted to talk about, which was, why do you think so many people, apart from what has been mentioned, what are the other problems? When I've done shows and I've mentioned insomnia, the number of people in the audience who say, I experience insomnia as well, and it is such a ridiculous thing. It's been mentioned before, this idea of you're exhausted all day and then you go to sleep and another part of your brain just kind of goes, ha ha, think you're going to sleep? I don't think so. And then my brain used to sing me Serge Gainsbourg songs over and over again to keep me awake. That's entirely true. Ballad of Bonnie and Clyde. So what is causing that?
Well,
how much time and money do you have?
Yeah. Well, in your particular instance, God knows. But why are people insomnia? For many different reasons, and part of it is worries and concerns, which are then going over to the night time. Part of it is, as you're saying, we don't value the night, and so you go into this bright bathroom and you're seeing stimulating material before you go to bed. Part of it is when you're in bed, you don't know what you need to do in order to fall asleep and manage your sleep. So, for example, there's a technique called paradoxical sleep, which is that if you are struggling to get to sleep, you try and stay awake. You have to keep your eyes open. You can blink, but you have to keep your eyes open and keep yourself awake. That's very tiring to do, and you end up falling asleep. Now, that's not a well-known technique. There's a fair amount of evidence for it. If you wake up during the night, lots of people lay in bed getting more and more anxious about the fact they're awake. They start to associate their bed with being awake. If you get out of bed for about sort of 15 minutes or so, do something in low light, such as a colouring book or a jigsaw or something like that, then get back into bed, then again, that all helps. So I think we just don't understand and we don't value sleep and the night, and we just need to educate people about how to sleep and how important sleep is.
Is there anything to the, I suppose, culturally, historically, dreams have been given terrific significance. So beyond what we know about the processes and sorting of information or whatever they are, is there anything to this Freudian idea, I suppose, of your dreams? Can you interpret them? Can you read them? Can they tell you something about yourself, your mental state?
Well, there are two questions in there. One is, are they meaningful? I think they are. The other question is it Freudian? And because to Freud, everything is about repressed sexual thoughts and aggression. You put them into the unconscious and they bubble up. And a lot of your ideas are completely untestical.
No one tell him.
Yes.
It's awkward, isn't it?
So Freud's idea, he wrote Interpretation of Dreams, which is one of the dullest books ever. If you're trying to get to sleep, it's quite a good book to read. Second only to his book on jokes, which is really quite something. So I don't think there's anything Freudian. I don't think all of our dreams have a sort of latent sexual meaning. However, there's some evidence that what we're doing is working through our concerns and worries, and the dreams reflect those concerns and worries. And so in a sense, you can gain some insight into your own worries and concerns and to those of your friends by looking at your dreams.
And only reflect them? Or are they? Is there any evidence that they're part of your process of dealing with them, coming up with solutions to them?
So there's many instances where musicians and playwrights and others have woken up with a complete tune or play in their minds, and the theory is they're kind of working on the problem during the night. And there's some evidence that if you write down whatever the problem you're trying to solve before you go to bed, in the morning increases the chances of waking up with a solution, which suggests there's quite a lot going on, and it may be that that's to do with dreaming. The other piece of data is that dreams start off, the first dream of the night, we all dream about five times, the first dream very negatively, and the first dream very negative in terms of emotional tone, and then they become more positive as the night goes on, which is another piece of evidence that maybe we're working through our problems in the dreams. But dreaming, very important.
Katie, are you the kind of person who enjoys the company of, or is indeed one of those people who goes, I had the funniest dream last night? Or not? Do you like sharing your dreams?
I love sharing my dreams. Everyone loves sharing their own dreams. I hate hearing about other people's dreams because other people's dreams are literally the most boring thing on earth. But my dreams are fascinating and I'm more than happy to share them to whoever will listen. So you're ideal, really. I mean, I'm happy to buy dinner later if I could just tell you about my dreams for 3 hours.
That's not going to happen, but...
I have to say, I have a slightly less romantic view of dreams. And the first point would be that if they were so biologically important, then we'd remember more of them. And I just feel it's the brain, it's an artifact of the brain trying to make sense of its world. So the analogy would be, you've got all this information coming in during the day, you don't have time to process it because you've got to make an immediate response to the world in which you're in. So it's like bits of a jigsaw puzzle that are parked. And then those bits of a jigsaw puzzle, when you're asleep, they're trying to be slotted into a half-made jigsaw puzzle. Now, sometimes it fits and you've come up with an innovative solution to a complex problem. But sometimes you're forcing that bit of the jigsaw puzzle into some weird place and you get these bizarre and strange associations. So I have to say, I don't feel quite so romantically inclined towards dreams.
So you think that they're an artifact of our model building, basically?
Yeah,
so
exactly
when you remove some of the stimulus.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course that's critical because there's so much information coming in. The brain can't deal with the processing as well as the receiving as particularly effectively. That's why sleep is so critically important.
Are you suggesting that the sleep itself is primarily biological in function and the conscious artifacts that happen, things like dreams, are really a side effect? It's really, it's mechanical in a sense.
In a sense, yeah, I think that's right.
So it's nothing to do with your stuff then. It's entirely mechanical. And all this stuff, thought, business.
Yeah, no mind.
Side effect.
No. So clearly sleep and dreaming is biological, of course, but I would argue there's also psychological functions involved in that. And if you take dreaming, often dreams are meaningful to people. They're not random in that sense. But it's amazing how complicated all of this is, and all going on outside of consciousness, of course. So if you take, say, dreaming, you can influence someone's dream by playing in music very quietly when they're in dream states. And so the classic one is, say, the alarm clock goes off and you hear it as church bells or something like that in dream state. And some of the research we've done has involved increasing or making more positive the emotional tone of the dream by playing in certain, like, nature sounds. It makes people have more pleasant dreams. And as part of that research, we had to collect a lot of dreams. So people waking up in the morning and sending in their dreams. And what I hadn't realised is
that... Are you
that...
the BFG?
Pretty much.
People send them in jars.
Yeah, well, they were small jars that arrived, and we kept them in the lab. Were, yes, exactly. Yeah. But what I hadn't realised, that we don't do that. I hadn't realised is that some dreams, and this isn't true of mine, but some dreams, like soap operas, they carry on from night to night. And so we had one woman who was met George Clooney in Boots when she'd gone in to buy some aspirin. And she's fallen in love, and the two of them started dating. And in her dreams, I should say. And then night after night, they were going on this very long-term sort of affair they were having. So it was quite fascinating to sort of realise that other people's dreams often carried on from one night to the next.
It's funny you say that, because ever since I started doing this show, I've been tormented by a nightmare of being attacked by a giant zombie strawberry. And I don't know if it's dead or alive.
The strawberry's dream, Russell. The strawberry's dream? No.
Well, thank you very much to the panel. We also, before we end the show, we do also have the answers of our audience to a question that we asked them, which is, we asked them, what keeps you awake at night? This is always the kind of light bit at the end where we see what you've come up with. And our answers have included heartburn and acid indigestion, headaches, and being too warm. So... which I like. I like the fact that, I should probably check. So Richard will cover what those issues are. But we also have had worrying about whether my strawberry is dead.
This says, the thought that if I'm asleep, I can't observe myself sleeping, therefore I may or may not be asleep. What can that person do?
It's sad, isn't it?
What keeps you awake at night? My husband, I wish. I'm not going to read that name out. The final one is bad D-reams. As well as three Brian Cox gazing at me through my bedroom window, putting on my Brian Cox mask. Hopefully Professor Brian Cox.
That's from Bob.
Yeah. That's Bob does that sound! So thank you to our panel, Russell Foster, Richard Wiseman and Katie Brand. Next week we are looking at the differences between males and females, which was originally going to be called Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus, but Brian took it very literally and started talking about the melting point of women. So
it's very hot on Venus. It's 460 degrees Celsius. Atmospheric pressure is 90 times atmospheric pressure. I just think it makes no sense.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll be dealing with that next week. Thank you and goodbye.
In the infinite monkey cage,
without your trousers.
In the infinite monkey cage.
Turned out nice again.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox.
Now, it may come as some surprise to our listeners that both Brian and I are male, despite the fact that when we walk around together, a lot of people come up to me and say, oh, you've got a lovely daughter.
Today, we're talking about the biological battle of the sexes, with a particular focus on genetics and neuroscience. How did sex evolve, and what are the evolutionary advantages that it confers? Whilst popular culture might suggest that there are differences between the brains of men and women, is this distinction supported by science?
For instance, it's a widely held belief that men are better at reading maps, whereas women are better at actually getting to the correct destination because they don't spend the whole time going, I know where I'm going! I know where I'm going! I don't think it is left! Well, I don't know why there's a quarry here! So, for this show, Brian has been researching by reading Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus.
I'm going to stop you there because I didn't get very far.
The author
knew nothing about atmospheric physics.
That's all.
It's planetary stereotyping. Venus, the goddess of love. Sulfuric acid rain, hottest place in the solar system. Women would dissolve and melt if they came from Venus. It's inaccurate.
Well, of course, men from Mars, their eyes would all pop out like in Total Recall.
No.
Okay, then they grow potatoes in a special tent. I've seen the film, I've done the research. So, to sort out the differences between male and female with as few complaints on social media as possible, we have a geneticist, a neuroscientist and a comedian, and they are...
I'm Steve Jones. I'm Professor of Genetics at University College London. I've wasted my career working on the genetics of snails. And they have an interesting sex life because they're hermaphrodite, simultaneously male and female. Okay, and that gives them two choices. What Woody Allen called sex with somebody you really love, yourself. Okay, they can self-fertilize. Or they can cross-fertilize. Boy, girl meets girl, boy. And what you want to be under those circumstances, as we'll learn, no doubt, is the boy, because that's much cheaper. How do they do it? They fight with their penises and one bites the penis off the other one. That's my favorite.
Welcome to Radio 4. You're listening to Gardener's Question Time.
Hi, my name's Sophie Scott and I'm a Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience from University College London, and I study brains, and I've come to the conclusion that your sex, whether you're male or female, is almost one of the least interesting aspects about your brain.
Brilliant. Well, it's going to be a fun show then. That's the... good.
My name's Sarah Pasco. Patricia, middle name. I don't like it. I shouldn't have said that in case my mum gets upset. I'm a comedian as my job, and my preferred mating strategy is my own. I know that most people meet someone in the workplace, so I've chosen an industry which is 10-1 male to female, and just let the odds work in my favour.
And this is our panel. Steve, we'll start with you after such a promising anecdote on the removal of penises in the snail world. Why do we have a female and a male sex in the first place? Why has that evolved?
That's probably the most difficult question in biology, because it's obvious that males make no sense, because what males do is persuade or force the opposite sex, females, to copy their male genes. Now, why would any female want to do that when we know that a tiny difference in your individual success in copying your own genes is what drives evolution? Why allow these men, these males into it? Well, nobody really knows, but the usual explanation is that evolution is basically a battle of all against all, that there are parasites, diseases out there, all of which are anxious to get you. So if you only have one set of genes, no sex, no exchanging genes and shuffling the cards, then you're vulnerable to any changes in parasites and disease, and they'll come and get you. So you've got no choice but to keep running.
But why are there only two sexes? Do we know that? I mean, you could imagine that you could share multiple copies of genes.
That too is very peculiar. I mean, if you define sexes, somebody of being a different sex to you, as somebody with whom you can mate successfully. Now, if there were 100 sexes, you could mate with 99% of the people in this room. What a delight that would be, okay? But nearly always there's two sexes. And that's because there's an enormous conflict between males and females in the strategy, the tactics they use when they're trying to get mates. Now, males are going for quantity rather than quality. In men, for example, every time a man has sex, he makes enough sperm to fertilize every woman in Europe, which is a frightening thought.
But there's less now.
That's true.
That is one of the
there
things...
Was, I believe there was a plan to set up one man in Brussels who was going to do the job.
That was on the side of that bus that we were going to get.
But so he makes, or males make lots and lots of small sex cells. So they need to make lots so they can compete with each other, find the females. Females can't do that because the egg has to be a certain size in order to have various forms of nutrition in it for the early embryo. So you end up with a situation that you always end up with the smallest possible sperm and the smallest feasible egg. but it's quite big. So if there's a third sex, then that would confuse the matter, and the smallest one and the second would then win again. The two smallest ones would win again. So you have just two sexes.
So, Sarah, do you think it would be easier if we were in a... I think the clownfish, for instance, that changes its sex, doesn't it? And I think there's also various different stacking limpets where you get a system where... Is it right? It goes male, 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 and then when you get to the bottom, you turn into a female. Would that be correct, Steve?
Yeah, well, it's got a great... The stacking limit has got a great name. Its Latin name is Crepidula Fornicata. That would look really good above a nightclub in Soho, I think. And what it does make a stack, and the one at the bottom gets to be female, the next one gets to be male, the next one gets to be female. Anyway, I think we shouldn't go any further into that. This is, after all, the BBC.
So with that, Sarah, do you think the idea, is it problematic? As a human being, this race and this battle that we end up in, the battle of the sexes, male and female, that in fact going for a system that we've just been talking about, the limpet or clownfish system, may make a happier human race?
Well, I don't think you can talk about happiness in animals that aren't conscious. So the difference between us isn't that they have a different system, it's that they don't have emotions attached to it. And like, yeah, last week he was above me in the stack, and this week he doesn't want to be next to me. I don't know what it means. Like, it's the emotions. Sex is making more people. It's genetics and bacteria, and we've got this whole other level going on. So actually, if we became stupider, then it wouldn't matter.
So...
I'm saying, what's the opposite of evolution? Involution? Devolution of the prefrontal cortex is going to be ideal for our species, and I think it might be happening. Have you been watching Love Island? I know I'm on the wrong show. Have any of you been watching Love Island? Mm-hmm. It's all going to be okay.
I was going to say, Steve, is it possible for us to de-evolve towards limpets?
Yeah, lots of creatures have given up sex, and gone, but it never pays off, and it's a great idea for a while, but if you look at there are some lizards even. just ask the Pope, he knows. But there are plenty of creatures out there, plants and also some animals, even there are some lizards which are all female. And what you find is they're out there, but if you look at the great tree of life, they're at the tips of the twigs. They don't actually, with very few exceptions, they don't generate great variety and diversity of life. They're kind of stuck in a one-way street.
Sophie, we mentioned in the introduction the idea, I suppose it's an urban myth in a sense, that there's such a thing as a difference between male and female brains. And you mentioned actually at the start that you thought that was unlikely to be correct.
Well, it is very interesting because it's a very, very widely held belief, and you'll see whole kind of domains of cognitive neuroscience. We'll take it as a starting point because it seems so obvious, and, you know, lots of other bits of the body look very different between men and women. I have got an A-level in biology. I can, you know, attest to this. So, you know, the logic goes, well, you know, the same would be true for brains. But in fact, all the studies that have looked for differences between male and female brains tend to find either very small effects that don't replicate or larger scale effects that basically reflect the fact that men are somewhat bigger than women and they've got bigger brains. So women's brains are scaled slightly differently. So very, very crudely inside the brain, you've got two different sorts of matter. If you cut a brain open, there looks like there's two different things going on. There's grey matter and there's white matter. Grey matter is where you've got the cell bodies, and that's where, really crudely, computation happens. Stuff gets worked out there. The computational power of the brain is in the grey matter. And then the white matter is the connections between that. And what you find is women have got proportionally more grey matter and less white matter than men, but simply because they've got smaller brains, so you're fitting in more of the stuff you need more of, and you need less of the stuff that's connecting it.
So it's an adaptation to the fact that the head is... smaller.
Exactly. So you've got, essentially, you're fitting the same kind of computational power into the
really box.
Is the variation between, let's say, and you just pick a male brain at random, a female brain at random, is the difference between different brains in the population larger than the difference between male and female brains? Would that not be a good differentiator, as it were?
Exactly. So lots of things mean that your brains will be different. So if I look around the room here, I can be absolutely certain there's going to be a massive amount of variation across the brains in here. I tend to think about people's brains when I look at them. Please try and get past this. But and we know some of that is just like accidents of birth. So, for example, we found people who are phoneticians, you know, they can kind of listen to you and say which bit of Manchester you've come from and how long you've lived in London. They have got bits of their brains that are simply more complex than people who have not become phoneticians. And that seems to be there from birth. It's a shape thing. It's not a size thing.
Oh, so it's not some sort of response to practice. Like, is that a myth? Yeah. Oh, it might be a myth about taxi drivers having a bigger...
Exactly.
Because they remember things.
You exactly find that. So you also find in the phonetician's brain areas that correlate with how many years they've been doing it, just like the taxi driver. So the brain's huge and very plastic. So some stuff you're born with, most of the differences actually come through what you get to do, your experience. So actually, over your lifespan, your brain changes hugely, partly because it's developing and then because of the stuff that you do. So if you really want to change the brain, teach someone to read, teach them to play a musical instrument. Or, for example, you know, the idea that women, you know, can't read maps and men can read maps. Well, it turns out kids growing up in Tanzania in very, very featureless environments are much, much better at spatial reasoning than kids growing up in Lancashire. Because they have to be. You know, so you actually, the environment that you're in and what you're exposed to as you're growing up and throughout your whole life, that's what really gives you the brain that you end up with. And I can't look at a brain and say, that's a male brain, that's a female brain, because...
I like the fact you picked up spatial reasoning and men from Lancashire, because he's from Lancashire and can rarely find his way from the toilet to the stage. So there may well be a link there.
But when you're talking about the difference between males and females' brains, which you've got, you know, needless to say, far more than I do, but... Surely the difficulty will be for a brain scientist. We know so little about the brain full stop that you'd scarcely expect any physically visible differences. There may be enormously subtle biochemical differences in there.
It is possible there are subtle biochemical differences, but they're not showing up at any of the brain scans that we're doing at the moment in terms of the anatomy of the brain or the function of the brain. So, for example... If I take a group of people and I scan you all reading, I'll find your age and your strategy for reading affects how your brain reads rather than whether you're a man or a woman. Now, that's on something that's supposed to be different between men and women. Language is supposed to be different.
But it's hard to deny, isn't it, that there are differences in behaviour between men and women in certain ways. The example I always give, and I can assure that I think the figures are accurate, is that men murder at 10 times the rate of women.
Yeah.
Now, the murder rate across the world... It varies by 100 times. I think the lowest level is in Singapore and the highest level is in Honduras. But if you go to Singapore and you go to Honduras, it turns out that the men in Singapore murder at 10 times the rate of women, ditto in Honduras. Although the average woman in Honduras is 50 times more dangerous than the average man in Singapore. Now, I mean, that's the joy of being a geneticist, because all you need to do is look at the genes, the Y chromosome, the male chromosome in this case, and look at the outcome. And we well know, and I'm sure you know better than I do, that there's an enormous gap between the gene and the outcome, but it's very hard to deny that there's some effect of at least the Y chromosome on behaviour, which women don't share.
Well, you would think that. In my field, what you'll find people try and explain is, why are there slightly more people doing maths who are men than people who are women, and why are there slightly more chess players who are really good who are men than women, and nobody... really wants to say, and by the way, for every one woman in prison, there are 25 men. Yeah. No one will say that's down to the brain, although you might think there might be something going on. You know, that's worse than engineering departments. It's a very, very bad set of statistics. And this is always the problem with science. It's not as sort of objective as we like to think it is, and people will set out to solve problems. At the moment, people tend to ask questions about, well, why are women less good at things, rather than saying, why are men really excelling at committing crimes?
And would it not be, I mean, just... because you know, would it not be, you could suggest it was a hormonal differences, though, for example,
It probably is. I mean, it's foolish to deny that the testosterone, which is a hormone which is very important for half this audience, I'm not quite sure which half, affects behaviour. If you abuse testosterone, as, say, bodybuilders do, then your behaviour changes, and many, many bodybuilders who inject testosterone come to a very unpleasant end. They die in car crashes, suicide, murders, all those kind of male pastimes. So it's foolish to deny that there are some biologically coded aspects of human behaviour.
It can't be simple though, because we know that in the brain testosterone is aromatized into estradiol, so it's working as an estrogen. Men have got two different routes to be effective. So it's wrong to think that testosterone is doing boy stuff and estrogen is doing girl stuff. Estrogens have a masculinizing effect on men as well.
What was that word? So testosterone is...
Aromatized. Into estrogen, an estrogen in the brain.
So what do you mean by aromatized?
Aromatase is an enzyme that changes it into an estrogen. Yeah.
The interesting thing about prison studies is what they thought, first of all, when they found out this thing about testosterone, the Y chromosome, especially the double Y chromosome in prisoners, they thought, oh, fantastic, we found out why men are more violent. parents, and then they found out that very, very successful men had exactly the same things. But, and actually, there were always other factors, and it seems to be a mixture of childhood conditioning, critical stages, brain injuries in childhood. There's this combination, and a lot of it is very social. And the same child, if it has a cold or aggressive family, might end up, and again, it obviously economics is related, might end up in a prison. And actually, the same boy with a lot of communication, a loving family environment, will end up being a very, very powerful, very important man, because they're both kind of equally intelligent and things like that. Yeah. So it's so, that's the thing, that's a terrible thing about dealing with something like sex or statistics and then trying to work backwards from it.
To summarise this piece of the discussion, as I understand it, there are no statistically significant structural differences that we can see between male and female brains.
Nothing showing up consistently in the scans that we do at the moment. So you can, you know, people might scan 20 men, 20 women, find a difference. What you'll find is you then try and run it again, you get a different effect. It's just, it doesn't replicate, because you need many, many, many more brain scans to do that. And when you do that, what you tend to find is actually the differences then are really, really small, or come down to just basic overall size. Yeah. So you don't find, unlike the rest of the body, you don't find whole other bits that aren't there in one sex.
And of course, if something is a behaviour, you have to be asking about social conditioning and those kind of things affect, and they do affect our behaviours.
So really what you're saying, Sarah, as well, is that pragmatically, a lot of this, it doesn't really matter. It can be something that, in terms of just the creation of this particular division, if you look at it pragmatically, well, we're worrying too much about
it. Yeah, I wonder why we're so fascinated with it, because actually, and I think that's the thing with the science, where they keep going back and doing these brain gender studies, we want there to be a definition, women do this more than men, and men are like this. Well, and it's so hard, isn't it, to go like, oh, maybe people are people.
I found, to be very crude about my area, it's very often the case that people will accept quite a low bar for data in my field when it comes to sex differences. So I looked at one paper where they were looking at spatial differences between men and women, and I think they had something like 8 men and 7 women. There was no difference behaviourally. They were the same on the test, and they found brain differences at quite a low statistical threshold. And I thought, if I was trying to say people who speak French are different from people who speak German, and I took 8 people who spoke French and 7 people who spoke German and actually found they weren't different, but no one would let me publish that paper. They'd sort of, they go, that probably is right, because they, men and women, so it sounds kind of different.
I mean, I think that's a crucial issue. I mean, it's, one of my favourite phrase from Charles Darwin is, ignorance more frequently breeds confidence than does knowledge. In other words, if you don't know what's happening, you can be totally confident. And that summarizes the history of genetics in particular, because as everybody knows, in the early history of human genetics, dreadful, unspeakable things were done by people who knew nothing about the subject. The same was true, of course, in the early history of brain science, or at least of psychiatry. They didn't know anything. I think in genetics, we've now got this thing called the Thousand Genomes Project, where we're awash with data. We just don't know what to do with it. Genetics has turned into computer science. And yet you pour all this data into these huge computer models asking about the inheritance of height, let's say, and men are taller than women. It turns out that we can't find the genes differences behind the inheritance of height. So I think the short answer is that life is much, much more complicated than we used to think so 50 years ago or even 5 years ago. And I think it'll get more complicated yet.
Can we talk about the genetics of sex? Maybe you could give us a quick lesson on what happens. So meiosis and those things that everybody learned at GCSE or O level and then forgot.
Well, I didn't bring my slides with me, unfortunately. I start my first year of genetics at UCL, 44 lectures of them, and I start off by saying, I'm a geneticist, and my job is to make sex boring. And the students look at me blankly, but when it comes to lecture 44, they know exactly what I mean. And that's the case with lots and lots of science. It's like brain science, which is tremendously technically demanding and doesn't answer questions about happiness, okay? But meiosis is actually a word from English literature. It means making things look smaller, mitosis, vice versa. Now, meiosis is what happens when sperm and egg are made. Everybody, as we all know, has got 2 copies of every chromosome in each of their cells, 46. And now when sperm and egg are made, there's this system where you have one division of the DNA followed by 2 divisions of a cell, so you end up with a sperm with 23 chromosomes and an egg with 23 chromosomes, and then they get together. Okay. Now, that sounds simple, but in fact, it's all tremendously complicated when you look at the machinery of making sperm and egg, because you've got two copies of each of chromosome 12, let's say, and they've got two arms each, and they come in a most romantic way, and they skirt round each other, and they fiddle, and they come together like this. Whoa! They stick together. And they make actually a forearm structure. And then just like our presenter's finger here, is that something gets cut and rejoined, and it's a bit like having two hands of cards. And you take the two hands of cards and you reshuffle them. And that reshuffling makes a new mixture. And that's why each one of us looks a bit like our parents, but not identical to them. And that's what sex really is. Sex is recombination, except sex is a shorter word.
I have to tell you, that isn't the most... I've had sex that's been more boring than that. that was pretty racy at times.
Yeah, but it's an interesting business because there are big differences in making sperm and egg. Rather obviously, I would say. You know, men never rest when they're going through making their sperm cells, because every man is making sperm all the time, even rubbing in, for example. Just to give you one example.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah, you stick it to him. He's been giving it to me all the time.
Whereas women make all their eggs before they're born, and they make them almost complete, then they release them at intervals throughout their reproductive lives. So that means there are more cell divisions between the sperm that makes a man and the sperm that makes one of his children than there are cell divisions between an egg that makes a woman and the egg and her child. Now, every time in meiosis or in cell division, you go through the job, there are more mistakes. So most mutations, or many mutations, happen in men other than women. And women actually do a lot to repair them, because women are very good at repairing broken DNA. So that's another conflict between the two sexes, which happens through meiosis.
So in cells in women, they're actually better at repairing errors than... male cells. Even the idea that there's a... Why is that?
Well, I'm not sure we entirely know, but you can see it, because I talked about this recombination business of cutting and splicing DNA in new arrangements. There's more of that in women than in men. Now, recombination involves cutting a bit of DNA and rejoining it in a new arrangement. And that's what DNA repair does. Now, everybody in this room is already a very different person from what they were when this program started. And that's not because your ideas have changed, or perhaps they have, but your bodies have changed. You've had millions and millions of mutations, but nearly all of them have been put right by this repair mechanism, and women are much better at doing the repair mechanism than men.
Ah. I'll take that.
I read something about the testosterone weakening the immune system.
It does. Yeah. I mean, that's another thing I mean, going for hours here. But testosterone, if you look at animals rather than humans displaying... Okay, red deer males, for example, roaring and doing all these ridiculous things. You look at their health. They're completely filled with parasites. They've got bugs boring into their skin. They're exhausted. Their immune system is way, way down. And that's because testosterone suppresses the immune system quite strongly. Mm-hmm. The claim is, and this is animal behavior, so we don't really believe it. The claim is, if you can cope and be big and fierce and angry and roar and shake your antlers about, even with a lousy immune system, you must be a really good father, have good genes, and therefore I'll mate with you. But there's a spin on, there's a negative side of that, which is that women are considerably more at risk of autoimmune diseases, where the immune system attracts itself. And that's much commoner among women than in men, because their immune system is much more efficient.
Well, no, just one final, because you mentioned Charles Darwin as well, that burden of thinking of the deer, thinking of the exuberance, thinking of the burden of flamboyance to try and lure a mate. And I think, did Charles Darwin say that the sight of a feather in a peacock's tail made him sick? Yeah, well, he was horrified by that. So that burden seems to become increasingly an evolutionary disadvantage.
Well, I mean, Darwin did say that. Whenever I see a feather on a peacock tail, it makes me feel sick. And the reason for that, and Darwin, you know, was a genius, as we know, he developed his idea of natural selection, that the reason for having, let's say, a bird having a tail or wings was to help it fly. and, you know, to get prey and to find somewhere to live. But the peacock's tail doesn't help it fly. It's a damn nuisance. And only males have got it. But then finally he had the idea of what he calls sexual selection, which is that one sex, usually the males, has to invest in attracting the females. And the way it does that is with diamonds are forever, a very expensive tail, what a very loud call. And in fact, oddly enough, nearly all what we see as the beauties of nature, bird song, flower colours, that kind of stuff, these are all sexual signals. Nearly all perfumes, expensive perfumes, are actually made by the sexual signals which are excreted around the anuses of deer, okay? And dogs sniffing. These are inhuman perfumes. So they're obviously, we have some of these, the remnants of these signals. Fortunately, they're just the remnants, unless you buy diamonds.
They never do that angle on the perfume commercials, do they? They never go straight from the image of attraction to the anus of a deer, and I don't know why. That seems to be a trick that's being
Johnny
missed.
Johnny Depp, anus of deer.
Yeah. You see, if you say it like that, anus de deer, then maybe it would work. So we asked our audience what they thought the biggest difference between males and females was. So men will do anything for sex, women will do anything for chocolate.
Oh, God, you're going...
Okay, it's a can of worms,
that,
this one.
That is a man that women don't want to have sex with. I'm sorry, my friend.
This one, perception of reality, that's from Sue.
Yeah. One is the weaker sex, driven by their emotions and prone to outburst. The other is female.
This is terrible. Is it we've descended into kind of UKIP?
The wistful allure of Brian Cox's scientific descriptions appear to have altogether different effects depending on your gender. I don't know. I'm not so sure. So, thanks to our panel, who were Sarah Pascoe, Professor Sophie Scott, and Professor Steve Jones. And next week we're going to be talking about Frankenstein, the history of Frankenstein, the story of Frankenstein, and indeed the scientific relevance of Frankenstein, which is very exciting for Brian, because as we know, he was stitched together by Magnus Pike and Heinz Wolf in the late 70s as part of the special edition of The Great Egg Race, hence the lovely skin. So, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Without your trousers in the infinite monkey cage. Turn that nice again.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox. Now, usually I have the upper hand because this is a science show, but today there's a strong literary component. So my colleague Robin, who is a B.A. Ons in English.
And two-time guest on Quote Unquote. Yes, G.K. Chesterton fans, look at me and weep.
Yes, Robin has the edge. So, where is this sentence from, Robin? Test. Did I request thee, maker, from my clay to mould me man? Did I solicit thee from darkness to promote me?
I think I know this one. I believe it is My Struggle, Conversations with Tony Hart and Morph.
No, and probably yes as well. It's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Now, of course, until recently, Frankenstein was the archetypal mad scientist until the media invented a new, more expensive one.
Look, oh. Look at that as well. I'm filled with magic and electricity.
Today we're talking about Frankenstein. June 17th was the 200th anniversary of the night Mary Godwin, soon to become Shelley, first recounted the story of the creation of a living being from inanimate matter, a process that we now know happened on Earth 4 billion years ago.
Though, of course, for the purposes of balance, when we say no, we can say there are other ideas that other people do also know, which include, obviously, panspermia as a possibility, the gendered rib hypothesis, and, of course, classically, snake malice and the evil apple. I have to admit, I found it almost irresistible not to say snake malice and the evil apple in the style of John Peel. Go, there we go, I'm a snake malice and the evil apple. And I think we'll be hearing quite a lot more from them in the coming weeks.
What does the story of Frankenstein, the modern Prometheus, mean in the 21st century?
We are joined by a panel of scientists, experts and grave robbers, and today they are
I'm Nick Lane. I'm an evolutionary biochemist at University College London. And my favourite fictional monster, well, there's quite a few of them, but I'm going to have to go, as a writer, I have to go with the Vogons, the poetry reading Vogons in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
I'm Christopher Frayling. I'm a cultural historian, professor of cultural history, and used to run the Royal College of Art. And I write about monsters and things, and literature and film. And my favourite, it's very difficult, you know, the Brits are very good at monsters, probably because we're so repressed. Think about it. That's it, yeah? And actually, the science of monsters, you know, is called teratology. Did you know that? The study of monsters? I bet you didn't know that. Anyway, my favourite monster would probably be Elsa Lanchester in The Bride of Frankenstein, who has a wonderful Nefertiti hairdo with a sort of streak of electricity in it, because she's put her fingers in the manes, and it's absolutely marvellous. Don't ask me to imitate her.
Hello, my name's Noel Fielding. I've played quite a lot of monsters, actually. Old Greg, the sea transsexual. Spirit of Jazz with his hat on fire. Lots more, but I can't remember any of them. Who's my favourite monster? Oh, it's difficult. I want to say Donald Trump now, but I can't. It's like a ginger Godzilla. It's difficult, but I think maybe Calibos from Clash of the Titans is my favourite monster.
Oh, that's a good choice there. Calibos is kind of pan-like monster,
yeah,
isn't he?
Yeah, and when I was probably about 8 when I first saw Clash of the Titans. It was around about the same time that my parents were quite into AC/DC, so somehow I fused the singer of AC/DC, Bon Scott, with Calibos and got a bit freaked out by that combination of a sort of pan-like character in leather trousers.
And this is our panel! Christopher, you mentioned Bride of Frankenstein, which, of course, I don't know, is it the final line, We Belong Dead?
We Belong Dead, says Karloff. His final line, yeah. Yes. Actually, they got it wrong. You know, it isn't the Bride of Frankenstein, it's the Bride of the Monster. And people very often confuse the name of the scientist with the name of the monster, which is interesting because they're kind of two sides of the same coin. So the bride, it should actually be the Bride of the Monster. You see what I mean? He's not Frankenstein's bride. She's not, yeah.
Or the creature. They call him the creature.
The creature, yes. In the book, you know, he's called the creature until he's born, and then he starts getting called the monster, which is interesting. And people start treating him as a monster, so he becomes more monstrous. But he's the creature before then. It's quite neutral.
Why do you think it is? I mean, Frankenstein is, as we said, it's 200 years since Mary Godwin actually dreamt it up, and it permeates so much of culture. For 200 years, it was a play, I think, within about 5 years of it being published, and then was many times adapted. What is it about that story which means so many things and so many different things to so many people? Why?
Well, I think it's partly the social responsibility of science theme. Scientists considering a sort of ethic of care versus an ethic of control, and scientists thinking hard about the implications of what they're doing and not saying, you know, I'm a pure scientist, it's the applied people that do it, don't blame me. It's partly about masculine science. You know, Mary Godwin felt strongly that, you know, the chaps were getting too much publicity for this. But actually, originally, Frankenstein, the first draft of it has been published now. The manuscript is in the Bodleian in Oxford. And it's much more pro-science than the published version. That Mary Godwin was really interested in science, and it's the first novel ever about the education of a scientist. So we get, you know, Victor Frankenstein going to the University of Ingolstadt and going through this amazing curriculum, which is basically the whole history of science up to 1816, and feeling unsatisfied by it. You know, it's not big enough for him. It's getting too experimental, too small, too specialised. I want to answer the big questions. So it's the very first novel ever written about the education of a young scientist. And she felt very strongly about the importance of science, but she also felt that there was a danger that scientists weren't giving second thoughts to what it was they were doing. Then, when it came out in a popular edition, she loses those nuances, loses a lot of the specific scientific references, and makes science into the bogeyman. And in recent times, you know, the prefix Frankenstein has been applied to so many things. You know, in the 20s, it was chemistry and gas because of the First World War. In the 30s, it was medicine. In the 1950s, it was nuclear. In the 60s, it was DNA. and then test tube babies, remember that phrase, you know, and then Frankenstein foods, and now artificial intelligence and genetic engineering, and the prefix Frankenstein has been applied to all of the, so it's come to stand for all our anxieties about scientific innovation, all distilled into this kind of metaphor. But it makes it much cruder than the original novel, which actually is saying, let's hear it for science, but let's hear it for science which is thoughtful, which is what Mary Godwin wanted. You know, she grew up in a household where Humphrey Davy and all the great scientists of the day would come to supper. I mean, she knew all these people. She in fact, the curriculum at Victor Frankenstein's university is based on Humphrey Davy's lectures. So she was into science, not an anti-science person at all. And Shelley, who became her husband, you know, he ran voltaic batteries in his rooms in Oxford. He tried to revivify a dead cat when he was an undergraduate. And he was into, you know, apparently when you visited, you know, all this muddling.
What is your view of it, Noel? Because your comedy has a gothic air. So.
I have played a lot of goths, actually, in Vampires and Goblins. I've been typecast. But I was thinking about the story of Frankenstein and thinking that I don't know if I've ever... Because the books, we used to borrow stories loosely. The Island of Dr. Morrow was one that we were really interested in, and in the zoo that we were based in. Bob Fosse was making animals out of lots of different animals, sort of fusing them like a sort of collage. But we were quite into H.G. Wells, and we were quite into... but I was thinking, did we ever do a Frankenstein? I was thinking about... Because we used to sort of try and nail down the sort of gothic sort of story that we were sort of emulating. And then actually I thought in my latest live show, I made a plasticine Joey Ramone, like a big tall plasticine, and he, yeah, all right. And I'm 43. And basically he was in a plasticine world, but there was a doorway into it, like Narnia, and I opened it and he came out and urinated in my face. So it was a little bit, like a punk Frankenstein in a way, where he was sort of coming out and causing mayhem. You know, I'd created this monster and it was trying to kill me.
Now, Nick, in your laboratory, you do very similar work, don't you, really, in terms of...